2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 174, Can a Mormon Be a Hobbit? A panel discussion featuring L. Rex Sears, Jason W. Anderson, and Laura A. Ryman.
The appointed hour has arrived. This session is Can a Mormon Be a Hobbit? A reminder for those of you who don't know, I see name tags on everybody, so that's probably nobody. Admission is by ticket or whatever they call it when you buy your way into the whole symposium.
Registration,
thank you. Okay. We have three people on our panel today, and we're hoping that you'll be helping us out as well. To my immediate left is Jason Anderson, a graduate of the University of Utah's Communication Department and Elders Quorum instructor. Equally important for purposes of this panel, he's a movie fanatic, and his second favorite movie this past year was Memento, and his wife Marcy is here with him as well. To Jason's left is a friend of mine, Laura Ryman. We were classmates together in law school. That having been said, I guess I've tipped both of our hands, we're attorneys. Laura is also a primary teacher, and apart from her husband, David, she also lives with a dog named Buddy. My name is Rex Sears. Like I said, I'm a lawyer here in Salt Lake. Hope you won't hold that against me. I just throw out a few introductory comments about the panel, and then first we'll hear from Jason, and then me, and then Laura. The organization of this panel naturally was prompted by a shameless desire to capitalize on the gratifying and dazzling box office success this past year of the first of three Lord of the Rings movies. I can see we've got a few people here, but we might not have capitalized as effectively as we'd hoped in that regard. More true, closer to the truth, the introduction of the movie certainly has a lot to do with the fact that we're doing this panel at this year's symposium. But I think the motivation actually derives from a deep love both of Mormonism and Middle Earth. As the abstract in the program indicated, this subject matter takes its cue from Tolkien's own observations about the Catholic character of his works. We will be exploring areas of consonance and discord between Mormonism and Tolkien's mythology, but we are not trying to stake Mormon claims or dispute papal claims to Middle Earth, and we will not insult you, Tolkien, or his cherished religion by claiming that Tolkien's works show the undeniably Catholic author to be an unwitting Mormon. With that introduction, Jason.
All right. This makes me feel like the classrooms where they tell everybody to move to the front, but I won't make anybody do that if they don't want to. At the beginning of 1997, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings was voted the greatest book of the century in a nationwide poll in Great Britain. Now, it seems to be the case whenever a work achieves mass popularity, many professional critics and others of the literati were not pleased. Here's some examples. Literary critic Robert Inglis on Being Told the News. And excuse me if I do like a stuffy British accent with these because it makes me feel more like character. His response, oh hell, has it? Oh lord, dear oh dear, dear oh dear oh dear. Sunday Times critic Susan Jeffries, who had just broken the news to Mr. Inglis. Personally, I won't keep the thing in the house, but I've borrowed a box set for the purpose of this piece. It sits on the table like a horrible artifact, giving off a stale, bedsitterish aroma. The sight of it filled me with depression. Writer Howard Jacobson, Tolkien, that's for children, isn't it? Or the adults slow. It just shows the folly of these polls, the folly of teaching people to read. Close all the libraries, use the money for something else. It's another black day for British culture. And a writer in the Guardian newspaper echoed the comic book guy from The Simpsons by simply calling Lord of the Rings one of the worst books ever. These and similar comments have continued on into the current media frenzy surrounding all things Tolkien with the release of the movies. One of these struck me as a convenient bridge between our two topics of discussion. In the foreword to a recent collection of essays about Lord of the Rings, editor and esteemed literary critic Harold Bloom commented, "I'm not able to understand how a skilled and mature reader can absorb about 1,500 pages of this quaint stuff. Sometimes, reading Tolkien, I'm reminded of the Book of Mormon." Not everybody likes Lord of the Rings. Not everybody likes Mormonism. I had considered just stopping there, but then I thought that perhaps we might delve a little deeper into our goal of examining how Tolkien's mythology fits or conflicts with Mormon mythology. Now let me begin by explaining what I mean, or more appropriately, what Tolkien meant by using the term myth. Tolkien was emphatic in his belief that a myth is not simply a made-up story. Joseph Pierce is a Catholic writer who wrote an excellent book on Tolkien called Tolkien, Man and Myth that examines his life and some of the things that helped him to form and write some of his works. And he relates the story of a discussion which took place in 1931 between Tolkien and two of his colleagues, Hugo Dyson and C.S. Lewis. The three were discussing the nature and purpose of myth when Lewis explained that he felt the power of myths, but that they were ultimately untrue. As he expressed it to Tolkien, myths are lies and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. "No," said Tolkien, "they're not lies." Tolkien continued, arguing that myths, far from being lies, were the best way of conveying truths which would otherwise be inexpressible. "We have come from God," Tolkien argued, "and inevitably the myths woven by us, though they contain error, reflect a splintered fragment of the true light, the eternal truth that is with God. Myths may be misguided, but they steer, however shakily, towards the true harbor, whereas materialistic progress leads only to the abyss and to the power of evil." And then building on this philosophy of myth, Tolkien and Dyson went on to express their belief that the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth that really happened. Lewis himself later cited this conversation as one of the pivotal events in his own conversion to Christianity. The death and resurrection of Christ was just the old dying God myth that is found in dozens of cultures, except that Christ was the real dying God, with a precise and verifiable location in history and definite historical consequences. Those were C.S. Lewis's words. The old myth had become a fact while still retaining the character of a myth. According to Tolkien, then, myth imparts truth. This is an interesting thought for Latter-day Saints, for although many are readily willing to concede certain stories and events of the Old Testament as symbolic events that teach gospel truths, others who insist the same thing about, say, the Book of Mormon are usually treated dismissively. What part, then, can myth play in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ? An interesting point of discussion may be, would the Book of Mormon still be useful to us if it taught true principles, but the events described therein were not literal? As Joseph Smith learned concerning the Apocrypha in Doctrine and Covenants, section 91, the Apocrypha, which itself contains many Old Testament myths, there are many things contained therein that are true. There are many things contained therein that are not true. Therefore, whoso readeth it, let him understand, for the Spirit manifesteth truth. And whoso is enlightened by the Spirit shall obtain benefit therefrom. Would the Book of Mormon be treated the same way as the Apocrypha? Would it lose its impact? I personally hope this is something that can be discussed here today. I haven't decided on an answer for myself yet because, frankly, I'd never considered it before I started looking into this. Tolkien's love of mythology can definitely be eye-opening. I'd like to turn my focus now to a specific aspect of the author's work that I feel offers several interesting comparisons and contrasts for a Mormon reader. First, let me give a little background. Rex, actually, you have me the book right there so I can at least show people if I haven't seen it. All right. When we read the scriptures and come across a reference to a story that seems to assume familiarity on the part of the reader, we usually just assume that the story was once written somewhere and is now maybe found in an apocryphal source or in the well of missing scripture that we talk about. However, when we read fiction, we assume that for all these references, the author has at most fashioned maybe a token backstory for the characters that perform the action in the novel. Though more likely, they're just making up names to add depth and flavor to their story as they need them. Tolkien's creative process was different. Fascinated by linguistics, Tolkien first created a working language, and then, understanding that a language cannot exist in a void, but must have a history and mythology behind it to give it life, he then went about creating that mythology. From the creation of the world up through thousands of years of stories and legends, and these stories he's collected together. And with this background in place, he then proceeded to produce The Lord of the Rings. As a result, every reference in Lord of the Rings, every battle or event, I don't know if there's maybe some people that are just familiar with the movie, but whenever they yell out some name or when they refer to some event that took place in the past, they all have actual stories behind them. Many of these stories are collected in what is arguably Tolkien's most important work, especially when discussing simple mythology. That's The Silmarillion. So that's the book, just in case. Now, The Silmarillion begins, appropriately enough, with the creation of the world. Tolkien expert Ralph Wood provides an excellent summary of this creation myth and some of the pantheon of gods that take place in this. And I wanted to use some of Tolkien's actual words because, besides the themes behind them, the beauty of the language is one of the things that makes them great. Now, from the very beginning, they're already. We can start picking apart and picking into things that sound vaguely familiar from scriptural stories we've read. And it's important to remember that Tolkien never described, and actually always stated, as Rex stated in his introduction, that The Lord of the Rings is a very religious and profoundly Catholic work. He never denied that his Catholic upbringing and his strong spiritual values played an important part in what he created. This is the beginning of the Silmarillion, called The Music of the Ainur. There was Eru, the One, who in Arda is called Ilúvatar, and he made first the Ainur, the Holy Ones, that were the offspring of his thought, and they were with him before aught else was made, and he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music, and they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, or but few together, while the rest hearkened, for each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came, and in the understanding of their brethren they grew but slowly. Yet ever as they listened, they came to deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. Now, this background is important because this is the story of the creation of the world, and it's the world that all the characters in Lord of the Rings inhabit. And as the creation goes on, Ilúvatar, the great god, has his children, these lesser gods, sing a song. And in this song, all the lesser gods believe that they're just singing for the beauty of the melody. That's all they can see, is the beautiful music that they can make together as each sings their different part of the song. But only Ilúvatar, the high god, knows that it's all for a greater purpose. And eventually he shows them that they're not singing just for the song's sake, but to create. And here's an example of that. Talking about the lesser knowledges of these gods compared to the higher knowledge of Ilúvatar. The Ainur knew much of what was and is to come, and few things are unseen by them. Yet some things there are that they cannot see, neither alone nor taking counsel together. For to none but to himself has Ilúvatar revealed all that he has in store. And in every age there come forth things that are new and have no foretelling, for they do not proceed from the past. And so it was that as this vision of the world was played before them, the Ainur saw that it contained things which they had not thought. And they saw with amazement the coming of the children of Ilúvatar, and the habitation that was prepared for them. And they perceived that they themselves, in the labor of their music, had been busy with the preparation of this dwelling, and yet knew not that it had any purpose beyond its own beauty. For the children of Ilúvatar were conceived by him alone, and they came with the third theme, and were not in the theme which Ilúvatar propounded at the beginning. And none of the Ainur had part in their making. Therefore, when they beheld them, the more did they love them, being things other than themselves, strange and free, wherein they saw the mind of Ilúvatar reflected anew, and learned yet a little more of his wisdom, which otherwise had been hidden even from the Ainur. And these children of Ilúvatar, he creates two races. He calls them the firstborn, and then the others are called either the secondborn or just the later or the younger children of Ilúvatar. And these are the races of the elves and men. And I know that Rex is going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later, about the importance of these different species isn't the word, sentient beings that exist in Tolkien's world. But as his creation goes on, and it's important, I'm going to mention here that J.R.R. Tolkien was not a fan of allegory. He separated that distinctly from myth. Allegory was a strict parallel to actual events where everything has basically a one-on-one comparison. And as a matter of fact, although C.S. Lewis was one of his dear friends for a great part of his life, He was not a fan of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, which were strict Christian allegory. While C.S. Lewis was a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien's work, he loved Lord of the Rings and encouraged him in all of its aspects. But we'll see as we look at some of this creation myth that Tolkien loved, that even though he expressed his distaste for allegory often, that some of this, maybe just from his spiritual background, actually does slip a little bit closely into allegory. For as the children of Iluvatar continue their creation of the world, one of the children begins to create his own music. And of course, he's one of the eldest of the children of the Ainur, and he's one of the greatest and most powerful and most wise, and his name is Melkor. But he begins to create his own music, and not for the beauty of Iluvatar, but he begins to create it for his own beauty. He wants to create his own beings and his own life. And we see, of course, distinct parallels to the story of Lucifer, and these only get more explicit as time goes on, where in fact, in the end, it even states that Melkor, in the end, he's not even able to create. In the end, he spends so much of his spirit in envy and hate, until at last he could make nothing save in mockery of the thought of others, and all their works he destroyed if he could. Now that's a little bit more than just coincidence myth that's similar to Lucifer. He basically retells the Lucifer story in his creation myth. But so much else of the creation myth, while it does have its parallels, and I'll just list off a few of those parallels that we can hopefully discuss as the panel goes on. He talks, that was already mentioned, there's a council of gods that work under a superior god. There's, in essence, a spiritual creation that precedes the physical creation of the world. It's interesting that nothing is created as explicitly evil. The potential for evil exists through the free choice of some of the children, but all other evil comes from listening to Melkor's lies, and that continues throughout the entire Lord of the Rings. Everybody that listens to the Dark Lord's lies is what turns them evil. There's also some differences. It's important to recognize that this creation occurs out of nothingness. In the beginning, there is only Eru, the great god, and he creates everything out of nothingness, which, of course, holds a little bit more closely to the Catholic upbringing than some of our Latter-day Saint doctrines. There's also a difference. Well, this is a difference that separates some of his mythology that he's created in the Silmarillion from other well-known mythology from cultures around the world, in that in many cultures, the god that seems to be the troublemaker is usually the god of the underworld. He's the one that has the dark character. There's the Hades and Pluto, or there's a trickster god like Loki in Norse mythology, of which Tolkien was a big fan. But this, in his creation myth, it's explicitly a Satan character that is destroyed by his own pride, and that's where the evil comes from. There's also lots of gathering of Israel, or gathering of the righteous, myths and legends throughout the Silmarillion. And there's also great examples of the workings of an evil mind. These are two of my favorite, in that the downfall of the wicked in Lord of the Rings usually becomes because they're so blinded by their own pride. For example, the great evil god Melkor, in the end, he's only thrown down because the rest of the gods basically come and get him. And he never foresaw that, because he had no pity himself, and therefore could not comprehend how the other gods would have pity on these children. He couldn't comprehend it, and therefore could not foresee his own destruction. And then later in Lord of the Rings, and I hope I'm not giving any spoilers here, I just wanted to let you know, everybody, the movies don't come out till December, but if you want to know what happens, you can read the books. They've been out for quite some time. But in the end, Sauron can't understand why anyone would ever want to destroy the Great Ring, because he would never want to destroy it, because it's all of his power is bound up in it. And because he can't see that, because he's blinded by his own pride, he basically leaves the back door open and allows his own destruction to come to him. I wanted to finish with just a quote from Tolkien. When somebody asked him to kind of describe his epic project, as he called it, he says, "Do not laugh, but once upon a time, my crest has long since fallen. I had in mind to make a body of more or less connected legend, ranging from the large and cosmogonic to the level of the romantic fairy story, the larger founded on the lesser in contact with the earth, the lesser drawing splendor from the vast backcloths, which I could dedicate simply to England, to my country. It should possess the tone and quality that I desired, somewhat cool and clear, be redolent of our air, the clime and soil of the Northwest, meaning Britain and the hither parts of Europe, and while possessing, if I could achieve it, the fair, elusive beauty that some call Celtic, though it is rarely found in genuine ancient Celtic things. It should be high, purged of the gross, and fit for the adult mind of a land long steeped in poetry. I would draw some of the great tales in fullness, and leave many only placed in the scheme and sketched. The cycle should be linked to a majestic whole, and yet leave scope for other minds and hands, wielding paint and music and drama. Absurd. And absurd indeed. Absurd that J.R.R. Tolkien, at my age, was well on his way to perfecting a language of his own creation, while creating a history of myth and legend that would serve not only as a context for that language, but as an expression of the spiritual beliefs and heartfelt morality of its author. And I ain't even that good at talking English good yet. And Elvish is a perfect language with a perfect mythology backing it up that he was able to create. It's a one-man mythology.
Let me begin with a confessional, and that is that I've been a Tolkien fanatic since elementary school. I was introduced to Middle-earth when I saw what I think was the premiere of the Rankin-Bass movie adaptation of The Hobbit on television, and it must have been about fourth grade. I was delighted when a friend of my sister's heard about my enthusiasm and pointed me to the books. Don't worry, by the way, this doesn't end up with some sort of soliloquy in Elvish or something along those lines. Over the next 2 years, I read both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings start to finish 5 times. In my early teens, I repeatedly devoured the Silmarillion and Unfinished Tales. Months after marrying, I made my wife read The Hobbit with me, and I read The Hobbit to my son when he was 3. When I heard about the new movies, I decided to reread the books that had so profoundly affected me as a youth, and I was delighted to find that I still love them. Of course, I have changed since I last read Tolkien's works. For present purposes, the most relevant development has been my formal training and personal study in philosophy and theology. I haven't always been a lawyer. Tolkien insisted that The Lord of the Rings is a fundamentally religious and more particularly Catholic work, and numerous commentators have explored religious themes or echoes, both real and, I think, imagined, in Tolkien's writings. So naturally, when I returned to Middle-earth, I also began looking into the secondary literature and viewing Tolkien's world through more scholarly eyes. Given Tolkien's own insistence that fairy is too serious and important a matter to be left entirely to childish consumption and tastes, I like to think he would approve, provided my studies complement and do not displace my experience of his stories as tales rather than curios. He once made the, in drawing this distinction, he made the observation that adults can study anything provided they do it as curios. They can even study bags, and I think he had some sort of study into the history of grocery sacks in mind that he was when he made that comment. That's what the context suggested. This essay is my first attempt to write about Tolkien. A common theme runs throughout my comments. As others have remarked, Mormonism has traditionally been a this-worldly religion, with its hopes, aspirations, and even its heavens solidly rooted to this earth that we live on. And Mormonism has also traditionally insisted that the natural order comprehends all, even the gods. In other contexts, I have not been shy about saying that I hope Mormonism stays the course. But Tolkien's otherworld Catholicism infuses his mythology, and his mythology stirs in me an appreciation and desire for otherworldly religion that other sources have failed to impart. Let's start in the beginning. As Jason read for us, Tolkien's mythology and metaphysics begin with Eru, the One, who in Arda is called Iluvatar. He brings into being the Ainur, the Holy Ones, and under his direction they begin the great music. To the music, each makes a unique contribution, deriving from the cast of mind with which Eru created and endowed her. After the great music is finished, Eru shows them in vision what their collective efforts have wrought. He then sends the flame imperishable into the void, giving being to Ea, the world that is, which before existed only in thought. Jason has already discussed some points of comparison between Tolkien's creation myth and Mormonism's. The first point of comparison I would like to consider begins with a point marked by Jason when he noted that Tolkien's creation is creation ex nihilo, from nothing. I think that observation bears further elaborations that enter into competing conceptions of divinity and humanity. Tolkien's creation account illustrates his idea of subcreation, perhaps best explored in his Leif by Nigel, a short story that is an autobiographical allegory that tells of a man who devotes entirely too much of his time to his art and not enough to his garden. Nigel is a painter consumed with a portrait, mostly of a tree and secondarily of its surroundings. He obsesses especially over the individual leaves of the trees. Nigel, of course, is Tolkien. Nigel's neighbor Parrish has a roughly opposite failing. Parrish grows excellent potatoes but has no appreciation for Nigel's art. A time comes when Nigel must leave his art and embark on a long-awaited and feared journey, an allegory of death. After a time in purgatory, Nigel takes a train to a lovely pastoral setting where he discovers his tree, completed and brought to full vigor and bloom. This is a quote from the story. He gazed at the tree, and slowly he lifted his arms and opened them wide. It's a gift, he said. He was referring to his art and also to the result, but he was using the word quite literally. Nigel exemplifies the subcreator's role. Exercising God-given powers of mind, the subcreator can formulate a vision. God then has the power to give that vision being, to make it real. The exercise of the power to conceive something new is subcreation, a derivative mode of the fully creative power held exclusively by God, and one respect in which we are made in the image of God. As Tolkien explained in his essay on fairy stories, quote, fantasy remains a human right. We make in our measure and in our derivative mode because we are made, and not only made, but made in the image and likeness of a creator. The Ainur, the holy ones of Tolkien's creation myth, are also sub-creators, like Nigel, like Tolkien, and like us. Their own existence and sub-creative capacities and the existence of the objects of their thought are, like Nigel's tree, gifts from Eru, the One, the Creator. Their sub-creative capacities are real, but dependent and derivative. By contrast, Eru's creative capacity is independent and absolute. Eru uniquely has the ability to impart not only form, but being. The concept of creation implicit in Tolkien's theory of subcreation and his creation mythology runs contrary to Mormon thought. As Joseph Smith taught in the King Follett Discourse, God himself had materials to organize the world out of chaos, chaotic matter, which is element and in which dwells all the glory. Element had an existence from the time he had. The pure principles of element are principles that can never be destroyed. They may be organized and reorganized, but not destroyed. Nothing can be destroyed. They never can have a beginning or an ending. They exist eternally. In Mormonism, all creation consists in imparting some new organization to previously existing materials. And although the point is now contested, older strands of Mormon thought also insisted that God has no power to bring a creative mind into existence. Joseph Smith's teachings on the human mind mirror his teachings about matter. I wish to speak of the mind of man. Where did it come from? All doctors of divinity say that God created it in the beginning, but it is not so. This again is from the King Follett Discourse. The very idea lessens the character of man, in my estimation. I don't believe the doctrine. We say that God himself is a self-existent God. Who told you so? It's correct enough, but how did you get it into your heads? Who told you that man did not exist in like manner upon the same principles? The mind of man, the intelligent part, is as immortal as and as co-equal with God himself. Underlying Tolkien's theory of subcreation is the recognition of a fundamental gulf between divine and human creative capacities. Human beings are subcreators and themselves objects of creation, but there is a higher creative power held only by God. At the outset of the great music in Tolkien's creation myth, Eru gathers the Ainur and asks them to begin saying, since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, ye shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices. After the music, and after showing the Ainur their sub-creation in vision, Eru declares, therefore I say, Ea, let these things be, and I will send forth into the void the flame imperishable, the same flame imperishable that gives the Ainur their existence. And it shall be at the heart of the world, and the world shall be. Eru's unique creative capacity is embodied in the flame imperishable. As you may recall from the movie, I'm assuming you all went, when facing the Balrog on the bridge of Khazad-dûm, Gandalf declares himself a servant of the secret fire. Gandalf's power and authority to deny passage to the Balrog derives from the status of his master as the only true creator. But as a Mormon, I have no secret fire to serve. My God is just a sub-creator like me. Mormon pundits have responded to the charge that Mormonism debases God to the level of humanity with the retort that, rather, Mormonism exalts humanity to the level of deity. However, the undeniable fact is that Mormonism denies to God what sets the One, the Creator, apart from creation. Mormonism does not teach that human beings join Eru in becoming keepers of the flame imperishable. Rather, Mormonism denies its existence. In other writings, I have not been shy about broadcasting my preference for anthropomorphic and finitistic incarnations of Mormon theology. But Tolkien stirs within me something that overtly religious or philosophical writings never have. Tolkien makes me sad that my mother religion has no room for the secret fire, the flame imperishable, the creative power that brings into being what before was not. There's a chunk in the middle on theodicy here that I'd be happy to talk to anybody about later, but in the interest of time, let's skip that. This panel is titled, Can a Mormon Be a Hobbit? The final thesis I have to present is that Mormons don't want to be hobbits, they want to be elves. And in Tolkien's view, that is a sinful desire, which betrays and denounces the gifts with which God has endowed humanity. I mentioned at the outset that I was introduced to Middle-earth through the movie version of The Hobbit. As I think everyone familiar with both that movie and Tolkien's writings would agree, the elves in the movie are a far cry from the elves of Tolkien's imagination. Tolkien's elves are tall and fair, the movie's elves small and gnarled. As reported in the Silmarillion, the elves are, quote, more like in nature to the Ainur, the holy ones, than human beings are. The elves are, quote, the fairest of all earthly creatures, and they shall have and shall conceive and bring forth more beauty. So where does that leave humanity? To human beings, Ilúvatar gave strange gifts. Ilúvatar declared that to them, quote, I will give a new gift. Therefore he willed that the hearts of men should seek beyond the world and should find no rest therein, but they should have a virtue to shape their life amid the powers and chances of the world, beyond the music of the Ainur, which is as fate to all things else. It is one with this gift of freedom that the children of men dwell only a short space in the world alive, and are not bound to it, and depart soon whither the elves know not. Whereas the elves remain until the end of days, and their love of the earth and all the world is more single and more poignant, therefore, and as the years lengthen ever more sorrowful. For the elves die not till the world dies, unless they are slain or waste in grief. And to both these seeming deaths they are subject. Neither does age subdue their strength, unless one grow weary of 10,000 centuries. And dying they are gathered to the halls of Mandos and Valinor, whence they may in time return. But the sons of men die indeed and leave the world, wherefore they are called the guests or the strangers. Death is their fate, the gift of Ilúvatar, which as time wears, even the powers shall envy. This characterization of death as a gift from God figures prominently in several other of Tolkien's narratives. In the central romance of the Silmarillion between the man Beren and the elf maid Lúthien, Beren dies and Lúthien's spirit goes to the halls of Mandos to plead for his return, but, quote, it was not permitted to the Valar to withhold death from him, which is the gift of Ilúvatar to men. Instead, Lúthien is offered the choice to become mortal. She does so, and after a brief return to Middle-earth, both Beren and Lúthien die and escape from the circles of the world. When the tale of their romance is composed, it is titled Release from Bondage. By the way, just a biographical comment on the significance of this story in Tolkien's thinking. His gravestone has the name Beren on it. His wife's has Lúthien on it. Whether that's a good thing or a bad, I'll leave to you to decide. But in any event, it accentuates the fact that this is, for Tolkien, central, this story. With the defeat of Morgoth at the end of the First Age, the men who were faithful to the elves are given a new land, Numenor, which is within sight of the easternmost of the undying lands that are inhabited by the Valar and those elves who left Middle-earth. But the Valar banned the Numenoreans from sailing too far west, too close to Valinor, the Undying Lands. As the Second Age wore on, the Numenoreans came to resent the ban. The elves from the Undying Lands, who trafficked with the Numenoreans, tried to dissuade them from their growing discontent. They said, "It seems that you desire now to have the good of both kindreds, to sail to Valinor when you will, and to return when you please to your homes. That cannot be. Nor can the Valar take away the gifts of Iluvatar. The Eldar, that is the elves, you say, are unpunished, and even those who rebel do not die. Yet that is to them neither reward nor punishment, but the fulfillment of their being. They cannot escape and are bound to this world, never to leave it so long as it lasts, for its life is theirs. And you are punished for the rebellion of men, you say, in which you had small part, and so it is that you die. But that was not at first appointed for a punishment. Thus you escape and leave the world, and are not bound to it, in hope or in weariness. Which of us, therefore, should envy the others? This we hold to be true, that your home is not here, neither in the land of Aman, nor anywhere within the circles of the world, and the doom of men that they should part was at first a gift of Iluvatar. It became a gift to them only because, coming under the shadow of Morgoth, it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness of which they were afraid. Under the influence of Sauron, the Numenoreans ultimately make a vain attempt to invade and conquer the Undying Lands, and they and the land that was given to them are destroyed. A faithful remnant of the Numenoreans escapes the destruction of their island and found the kingdoms of Arnor and Gondor in Middle-earth. Now we get back to the story that I assume everyone here is familiar with, and perhaps all of you have read these other works as well, but we get to the character Aragorn from the movie. Aragorn is descended from the kings of the faithful Numenoreans. In addition to a new land, the Numenoreans were granted longer life. The Numenorean kings, before they became corrupted, voluntarily surrendered their thrones to their sons, and they voluntarily went to the chambers of the dead, where they lied down on their deathbeds and surrendered their lives. As the Numenoreans lost faith and began to hunger for immortality, they began to cling to life until it was taken from them. Aragorn's death scene, recorded in Appendix A to The Return of the King, shows his fidelity to the older order. I'm going to summarize good chunks of this. Aragorn goes down the house, down the silent street to the House of Kings, and lies down on it, calls his son to him, gives his son the throne, the crown and the scepter, and then his wife, who you may recall is, again, hope we're not giving anything away, but the romance that Aragorn has going in the first movie, he marries Arwen, the daughter of Elrond. And she makes the choice of Lúthien. She becomes mortal. Now, she's here with Aragorn while he's dying, and despite the fact that she ought to know better, she ought to realize that this is the right thing to do, now that it's come to it, she begins to realize why it is that human beings find death to be grief. "Lady Undomiel," said Aragorn, "the hour is indeed hard, yet it was made even in that day when we met under the white birches in the garden of Elrond, where none now walk." Blah, blah, blah. "Take counsel with yourself, beloved, and ask whether you would indeed have me wait until I wither and fall from my high seat, unmanned and witless. Nay, lady, I am the last of the Numenoreans and the latest king of the elder days, and to me has been given not only a span thrice that of men of Middle-earth, but also the grace to go at my will and give back the gift. Now, therefore, I will sleep. I speak no comfort to you, for there is no comfort for such pain within the circles of this world. The uttermost choice is before you." I'll skip that. Let's see. And he concludes with, "Behold, we are not bound forever to the circles of the world, and beyond them is more than memory. Farewell." Faced with Aragorn's passing and her own imminent death, Arwen finally understands the temptations of humans to seek immortality. Now, in a letter, Tolkien elsewhere explained that the elves are immortal, but not in an eternal sense. They just live for as long as the world does. The principal failing of human beings is they try to have the relatively immortal existence of the elves. The elves, in turn, get tired of things changing, and they want the world to stay the way they remembered it. And those are their twin failings. Galadriel's narration at the beginning of the first of the new Lord of the Rings movies clearly conveys the impression that the story is about power. Tolkien thought otherwise, and said so in several letters. I might say that if the tale is about anything other than itself, it is not, as seems widely supposed, about power. Power-seeking is only the motive power that sets events going, and is relatively unimportant, I think. It is mainly concerned with death and immortality, and the escapes, serial longevity and hoarding memory. Serial longevity is what human beings are after. They don't want to leave this kind of existence that we have right now. Hoarding memory is what the death is what the elves are up to. In yet another letter, Tolkien expressly endorses as his own the view, quote, that men are essentially mortal and must not try to become immortal in the flesh. But that is precisely the Mormon conception of salvation. Our ambition as Mormons is to achieve the immortality, the serial longevity of Tolkien's elves. We do not aspire to escape the circles of the world, to take advantage of what Tolkien saw as God's gift to us. We aspire to make our place within it permanent. We cling to time rather than seeking release from it. Mormon soteriology is thus directed precisely to what Tolkien says the Lord of the Rings preaches we should not seek. Here again, I find that Tolkien's writings have the power to make me desire something in my religion that I have in other contexts eschewed. I have elsewhere insisted that the primary significance and virtue of Mormon teaching is its comprehension of the afterlife through earthly human categories. But Tolkien's vision of death as a gift of escape from the circles of the world makes me wonder if, whether, in the eons of time, we might indeed tire of the perpetuation of our earthly existence, worlds without end. Tolkien makes me wish for the prospect of something fundamentally different, something wholly other than our experience here as a final escape. For these and other reasons, I do not think a Mormon can be a hobbit. Ideologically, Middle Earth is and must remain an alien place. Tolkien's Catholicism has an otherworldly cast that Mormonism, at least the brand of Mormonism I generally prefer, rejects. Middle-earth is of passing importance, while in Mormon thought this world is of final significance. Tolkien's own otherworldly religious background infuses his subcreation, rendering it an inhospitable place for my this-worldly religious heritage.
My comments are aimed more at The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which may be more or less familiar to you, those of you in here. It shouldn't really matter. I guess first I'll address Rex's question that was posed to all of us, whether a Mormon is a hobbit, could be a hobbit, should be viewed as a hobbit when reading the trilogy. Then address the role of Gandalf in the grand scheme and how that relates to our own, how would you call it, religious structure. And then finally, just touch on what Rex was touching on, the role of pride and power as ultimate corruptors. I love the description of the hobbits in the books. To me, it's really clear. And it says in The Hobbit, which is the first book, for those of you who don't know, there's the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and the movie that just came out was the first book of that trilogy. The Hobbit is sort of like a prequel. It's like episode one of Star Wars. And it gives a little more background. And Tolkien's description there says, they are or were a little people, about half our height. Hobbits have no beards. There is little or no magic about them except the ordinary everyday sort, which helps them to disappear quietly and quickly when large stupid folk like you and me come blundering along, making a noise like elephants they can hear a mile off. They are inclined to be fat in the stomach. They dress in bright colors, chiefly green and yellow. Wear no shoes because their feet grow natural leathery soles and thick warm brown hair like the stuff on their heads, and they laugh deep fruity laughs, especially after dinner, which they have twice a day when they can get it. I don't know if this describes a Mormon or not, culturally. The upshot is that they're ordinary, peace-loving little people with a taste for very simple pleasures like good food. Later he says 6 meals a day where possible, which I support totally, drink, pipes, clearly not in favor currently, and visitors. These very simple qualities ground our hobbit heroes and make them maybe more human and approachable than the elves and the dwarves and the orcs and the ents and the other races of characters that populate Middle-earth. It also, to me, reflects a level of contentment and peace with the immediate and the present that many Latter-day Saints may lose sight of in our continuing quest and the emphasis placed in the church for self-improvement. Hobbits are very grounded in the present. They are very grounded in the immediate, and they only move beyond that when they leave the Shire. The Shire is where they live. It is itself set apart, almost a separate world from the rest of what is called Middle Earth. And I think it has an unintentional parallel, perhaps, with the early migration of the pioneers, because Tolkien describes their arrival in the Shire thusly. Two brothers with a great following of hobbits set out for a new western land. At once the western hobbits fell in love with their new land, and they remained there, and soon passed once more out of the history of men and elves. While they were still a king, they were in name his subjects, but they were, in fact, ruled by their own chieftains, and meddled not at all with events in the world outside. To me, that's a people set apart. Perhaps the most important migration, though, is the departure of hobbits from the Shire for various quests, particularly Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit and Frodo Baggins in the Fellowship of the Rings trilogy. And what significance is this departure in terms of LDS theology? Well, it can be seen as leaving a home above. There's images of a near-perfect, peaceful home, untroubled by cares of the outside world. It says they were, in fact, sheltered, but they had ceased to remember it. To me, that's an interesting parallel to the image of, in order to appreciate what we had in the spirit life, we had to know adversity. Or you could say the Garden of Eden might be an easier translation. In order to know good, you had to know bad. To know happiness, you had to know sadness. The hobbits were, in fact, sheltered, but had ceased to remember it. Like Bilbo and Frodo, our spirits ventured out from a sheltered environment, partly in order to gain an appreciation for the fact it's sheltered. Like them, our goal is to return to that environment. But the motivations really differ, and I think the comparison breaks down like most literary things like this. Bilbo leaves for adventure. He's perfectly happy. He doesn't have to go. He just kind of feels a little restless. I haven't really heard that interpretation of the choice between good and evil in the Garden of Eden. Boredom. But Frodo leaves, partly because he's restless, but largely to protect his people in the Shire. And there's just no parallel in the LDS theology that if we didn't choose to come to this life, the spirit world or the Garden of Eden stood in any danger. And I think it's important to recognize the distinctions as well as the similarities. The goal of the Fellowship of the Ring, of the whole quest, is preservation of their way of life. Getting back to the Shire and keeping it the way it is, safe and happy and grounded in the immediate and the present. Well, our goal as Latter-day Saints is progress and self-improvement and change and development. And as discussed, Tolkien did not intend this to be a pilgrim's progress or a straight allegory. This is a plot-driven story. It's more of a myth, and it's not a morality play. And I think it's important to realize those. One of the familiar figures to you from the movie might be Gandalf. As the hobbits leave the Shire, they are guided and befriended by Gandalf. Gandalf is a tempting character to use when looking at this from the perspective of theology. He's extremely powerful. He's kind. He's good. He oversees the activities of nearly everyone in Middle Earth, some of them we don't even get to find out about. Brings to mind immediate comparisons with some sort of, it may be a stretch to say a heavenly father, but at least a prophet. Someone who has a very wide range of power, but is ultimately a much more complicated image of spiritual leaders than what is typically accepted within LDS theology. I like it, but see what you think. One would be his elusive nature. They can't control him. He leaves at times when it seems that he's most needed, the best example of this being Mirkwood Forest. You don't have to know the story. It just lets you know that they get to this part where they are instructed to remain on the path. This is a recurring theme, on the path, straight and narrow. I'm not making this up. Stay on the path is repeated so many times. At their peril for what will be, what they are told, the most dangerous part of the whole journey. And the dwarves and Bilbo pretend to send back their ponies, prepare to send back their ponies. And Gandalf then says, oh, I'm going to be keeping my horse. And they all look at him, no, you're supposed to send back the horse. And then I'll read Tolkien's description. He says, and then they knew Gandalf was going to leave them at the very edge of Mirkwood, and they were in despair. But nothing they could say would change his mind. He says, now we had all this out before. It's no use arguing. I have, as I told you, some pressing business away south, and I'm already late through bothering with you people. We may meet again before all is over, and then again, of course, we may not. That depends upon your luck and on your courage and sense. And I'm sending Mr. Baggins with you. Straight through the forest is your way out. Don't stray off track. And if you do, it's 1,000 to 1. You'll never find it again and never get out of Mirkwood. And then I don't suppose I or anyone else will ever see you again. And he leaves. I have to say, the first thing that popped to mind when I read this is the dark humor is something that just isn't present in our theology. There's questions of omniscience. There are indications that he's not concerned, really, right? He's telling, no, 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 we've had this all out. Don't bother me with your whimpering. Just, is he saying, have faith in me? Is he not concerned because he knows how it will end up? Or is it just a fatalistic attitude that he really feels like, well, whatever will happen, that's out of my control? I like that it encourages self-reliance. Luck, courage, and sense were the three things he identified, and Bilbo. Luck, not an aspect of our faith, although certainly something we see in all our lives, whether we call it luck or coincidence or blessings. I really think these three things are referring to the same sort of element of the unknown that appears in our lives and is out of our control, and you just hope that it happens in the right way. Courage, endurance, bravery, faith, hope. I think these are all synonyms for what he's talking about, courage. It doesn't have to mean in battle. These are cornerstones of our theology. Sense, not appealed to often enough, in my opinion, in our theology. What Tolkien calls sense may be more akin to the LDS buzzword free agency. Free agency refers perhaps more to the ability to make choices than the aptitude or sense that we display in making those choices. It's a subtle distinction, but I think that it exists. But both terms appeal to the individual's ability to get through the forest without direct guidance each step of the way from wiser, stronger parties who could help if they so chose to. This appeal to sense also illustrates a deep contrast between Gandalf's conduct and our church's notions of leadership and divine guidance. They may be more realistic. It's not that our leaders aren't there for us, but sometimes as we founder, grasping for explicit answers, the absence of answers is itself a response. It's simple to recite the platitudes regarding the omnipresence of our spiritual leaders, and I do it many times in primary, but in my life, it's more difficult to reconcile that principle with the actual experience, as well as the clear role of free agency. Not just the ability to choose between clearly laid out options, but the opportunity to discover what options there are. The more involved a leader or explicit standards are in our decisions, the more straightforward, and arguably thus less character building, the process becomes. Let's skip ahead a little bit. I think that Gandalf could be read, rather than a proxy for a particular religious figure or even role, as a parallel to the incidents of miracles in the Book of Mormon. Think about it. He shows up, he conducts a magical rescue, he advises the company to stay on the path, and he leaves. Time passes, the impact of his advice diminishes, things begin to fall apart, and a new miracle is needed to restore order and hope. It's a recurring cycle. And I think the similarity between this cycle and the cyclical conversion and falling apart that repeats itself throughout the Book of Mormon, Laman and Lemuel, the Nephites and the Lamanites, how many times do we see the pattern? It almost at times makes me forget which chapter I'm in. Something big happens, either a vision or a prophet. There's a mass conversion. People are enthused. They're convinced. And then time passes. And usually they get prosperous and things happen and it's further away and there aren't as many people who remember that great day when we saw the vision of Christ. And what do you know? Suddenly people are falling away. And then it's time for a new miracle or a new prophet. I think it's a similar cycle. As I mentioned, as illustrated by the Mirkwood Forest incident, our little adventurers are frequently instructed, do not leave the path. But ultimately, at least in the Mirkwood case, it appears that leaving is actually the only way that they actually get through the forest. The only parallel I can think of off the top of my head was, you know, the tree of choice between eating from the fruit of good and evil or having staying in the Garden of Eden and being unable to procreate, which I have heard as described as a necessary choice, even though apparently contradictory. See, even though they're instructed to leave the path in the story, and I'll just give you the brief recap, they see visions of food and elves eating, and so they stray from the path because they're very, very hungry. And every time they get closer, it's a mirage, and it vanishes further away. And to cut a long story short, they get captured by spiders, and they fight their ways free, and they get captured by wood elves, and they fight their way free. And ultimately, they escape, hiding in barrels that float through the forest from the wood elves' chamber to their ultimate destination, a place called Lake Town. Not on the path. The path that Gandalf had warned the company never to leave apparently had become unsafe in recent times, and only the river through the Elf Kingdom could have brought them safely to their destination. And Tolkien describes it thus. So you see, Bilbo had come in the end by the only road that was any good. It might have been some comfort to Mr. Baggins, shivering on the barrels, if he had known that news of this had reached Gandalf far away and given him great anxiety, and that he was in fact finishing his other business, which does not come into this tale, and getting ready to come in search of their company. What is the lesson here? Again, we should remember that it's a plot-driven tale and not meant to have a lesson with every incident. But there are some elements of uncertainty that don't sit well with strict LDS theology, but that I think are an interesting source of thought, pondering, if you will. One, leaders are not infallible. This is a clear contrast with the direction that the church is going now. And yet, surprisingly, there's no one in this company who then decides Gandalf is not worth following because he was wrong about the path. It doesn't happen. Second, plans change. People adapt, even though the end goal remains constant, get to Lake Town. The means of doing so changes based on the circumstances, based on change, based on cultural factors that were beyond their control. Three, you can't see the end result of some choices, even those that apparently are black and white. I find this to be a very insightful point. As you're reading the book, to me, I kept thinking, stay on the path, you idiots. Don't you get it? Stay on the path. And it turns out I was wrong. They were, you know, it works out the best for them. And for me, that leads to the most hopeful aspect of this little incident, which is persistence, not giving up, even though once you have left the path, it seems like you're just gone. You've broken the commandment. You've fallen away. But they keep trying to get to their ultimate destination, and that persistence is rewarded, and in fact, it turns out to have been the only way that they could have gotten there. Which brings me to an interesting note about prophecies, because perhaps leaving the path was the plan all along, despite the reference to Gandalf's apparent lack of knowledge about the changed conditions. I don't know how to deal with that, but perhaps it was the plan. At the very, very end of The Hobbit, there's this conversation between Gandalf and Bilbo, which I love. And they say something snide about, oh, now it looks, you know, they're doing all these things, so it looks like those old prophecies are actually coming true, and, you know, it's really just us. And Gandalf says, surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself. You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I'm very fond of you, but you are only quite a little fellow in a wide world, after all. I love this because it's the interaction of free agency and divine intervention and prophecy all in one. It's the age-old question of, you know, did the disciples write their gospels in order to conform with the prophecies that had existed beforehand, or did everything neatly conform the way it was planned? And answers it by saying, does it matter? Like, as we've discussed earlier, if myth has something of truth in it, and at some point something happens that is true and fact-based and is also like a myth, it's almost a chicken and the egg problem to me. There's a grander scheme at work, also, than individual salvation, clear implications of an overall plan that takes into account each soul, no matter how small, short, or hairy, and yet does not elevate one or the other over the other. Bilbo had a role to play, but this didn't mean he should be elevated unto some higher status greater than his peers. The glory goes to God, or in this case, to Tolkien's higher beings and the greater purpose that appears to float around the entire scheme of Middle-earth. You might respond, this is an insulting minimization of one individual's importance. I like to think that I matter, that I'm not just a little fellow in a wide world after all. It's interesting to note Bilbo's reaction immediately after Gandalf's comment. He says, thank goodness, laughing and handed him the tobacco jar. I find this a refreshing acceptance of one's role without transforming it into an excuse for inaction. The last theme I'd like to discuss is power and pride. Despite Tolkien's denial that power is the principal theme, it certainly is a well-recognized and often discussed theme throughout Fellowship of the Rings. Power as both an attractant and ultimately a corrupter. The Book of Mormon contains a similar, if not identical, theme regarding the corrupter now commonly referred to by church authorities as pride. In my opinion, pride and power share several similarities as obstacles to our respective quests. However, the proffered solutions by Tolkien and the LDS theology are quite distinct and I think interesting in their differences. As I mentioned earlier, there are the similar cycles. And specifically, there are increases of pride or power that correlate with increased corruption. In the Tolkien series, the ring is possibly the most obvious embodiment. People can't touch it, they can't think about it, they can't deal with it without becoming corrupted, tainted. In the Book of Mormon, it seems to be prosperity. Whenever earthly life gets just too easy, it's easier to fall away from the teachings and the things that may have brought you that prosperity in the first place. Similar cycles, up and down, back and forth. Different solutions. Tolkien, I find the lesson, and this is my interpretation, but that avoiding the corruption that comes with ultimate power, at least, is futile. You can only hope to limit the amount of power, i.e. by destroying the ring or refusing to wear it. Two characters, at least, refuse to wear it. Gandalf and the woman Galadriel, for example, know that they will be corrupted by it and refuse to touch it. But most people are unable to even reach that decision, and that is why the ring they offer must be destroyed. There's a very, for everyone who's seen the movie, you'll be familiar with the scene, and it's better in the book, of course, but towards the end, where Boromir, who is a good man, believes that the repeated warnings about the corrupting power of the ring do not apply to good and brave men, and attempts to take the ring by force, only to have Frodo flee with it. And they have this exchange. Boromir says, "For you seem ever to think only of its power in the hands of the enemy, of its evil uses, not its good. The world is changing, you say. Minas Tirith will fall if the ring lasts. But why? Certainly if the ring were with the enemy, but why if it were with us?" Frodo responds, "Were you not at the council? Because we cannot use it. What is done with it turns to evil." Boromir, "We of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial. We do not desire the power of wizard lords, only the strength to defend ourselves, strength in a just cause. And behold, in our need, chance brings to light the ring of power. It is mad not to use it, to use the power of the enemy against him." Arguably, Boromir's motives were pure. He wanted the ring to defend his people in Gondor. I don't see any reason to doubt that those were his motives, at least initially. But the desire for power still altered his conduct. He begins to think more about how important that would make him, how he could marshal men to come to him, and how the battles would be great that he would win. And it causes him to attack his friend trying to take the ring. This brings to mind the recurring question of whether it's possible for good and noble ends to justify bad acts or the use of evil power for a good cause. Tolkien appears to answer this cannot be justified, but that the willingness to resort to the bad act in itself indicates a change of character and perhaps a less than pure motive. Or perhaps it is simply that no individual can bear the pressure of great power without being changed by it. And thus the solution to destroy the ring, to make it so no person can have that much single power. LDS approach, I think, varies depending on the type of power. We don't have a ring. We don't have a concentration quite that absolute. But this is our approach, I think, to power and pride. If it's an increase in spiritual or divine power, you might say priesthood power, I would prefer to make it a little broader than that. But that should only increase with increase in moral structure, we are taught. The essence of approaching godhood. Right, the notion of eternal progression being that as we progress spiritually, we will increase in authority and responsibility and power. This structure allows us to believe that any power we have is commensurate with our readiness. An interesting question of whether this is necessarily true if the power comes from some other less than divine source. I'm not referring to simply Satan's grasp or some sort of dark magic, but rather our own more mundane but very human desire to believe that we are entitled to exert what authority comes into our hands, over the environment, over less developed cultures, over those with different values than our own. To accept this power structure as necessarily true smacks of manifest destiny and other oppressive means of self-justifying conduct. B, this would be the alternative type of power. I think that as a church we are taught to believe that earthly power is fine as long as you impose virtues, particularly humility, on the uses of earthly power. This begs the question raised by Tolkien of whether we can ever accurately realize or predict the onslaught of baser instincts that accompanies power and power-seeking. I suppose I tend to side with Tolkien in believing that ultimate power will ultimately corrupt despite the best intentions. How does this impact the traditional notion of progressing towards godhood and arguably ultimate power? I think it serves as a warning. Proceed with caution and full awareness of our own susceptibility to that recurring demon pride, as well as our own motives in seeking godhood. Otherwise, it is simply too easy to utilize local or personal prosperity, peace, and power as proof of our worthiness, moral fitness, and therefore a justification for imposing our moral standards, implied superiority, and resulting choices on others. So while distinct and certainly not intentionally LDS, I think that Lord of the Rings and the Tolkien papers offer some interesting topics of discussion for the LDS Church. Thanks.
Thank you, both of you. We have about 25 minutes remaining for questions. Those of you who do have questions, if they're short, I can just repeat them into the microphone for you. These are being recorded, so we want to be able to have everything heard in the microphone. If you have a longer question, feel free to come on up and use the mic. Or comment. Unless one of the other panelists has a different approach, I'd like to ask that you come on up here and give us one or two examples of what you're talking about to work with. Is that okay?
Okay.
This is why we told everybody to sit in the front, so you don't have to make the long walk up the aisle.
What I mean is the whole Tolkien, The Hobbit and The Lord of Rings, and probably thousands of books since, have taken up the theme of the quest, gathering up the members of the fellowship, and then going on to a great cause of which there are overwhelming odds. It looks dreary and absolutely impossible at certain times. And only through loyalty to each other and extreme sacrifice and friendship do they survive through these terrible experiences. However, it is ultimately not as a group that they do the most stupendous things, but rather, for instance, Frodo ultimately has to be the one who goes to the fearfully all by himself, not even with his best friend, who says, "I won't leave you, I won't give you up, I'll never leave you." And this is through the whole movie, through the first book, you believe that. But ultimately, Frodo goes to the mountain by himself and has to face the fear, the ultimate fear, by himself. In some ways, I see that as a truly religious sort of a theme there, that we can't have ultimate salvation with anyone else. It has to be an individual quest, but we get so much strength and power and hope from each other in the going about this quest, or maybe life, or whatever it might symbolize. And I just thought if that might have struck any of you.
Listening to your question, I'm not going to answer it. I'm going to add to it and then see what our other panelists have to say. You mentioned Frodo going into Mount Doom alone at the end of Book 3. And, of course, Frodo fails. He gets there, and he can't do it. He can't bring himself to throw the ring in. Luckily, Gollum comes along, bites off his finger, and jumps into the fire. But there are a couple of interesting dimensions of that have been pointed out by other commentators. First off, it's in marked contrast to Bilbo's experience going into the Lonely Mountain. As you may recall, there's a similar story there. Bilbo is going down the secret passage into the room where where the dragon is, and halfway down, his good buddy Balin says, "Well, Frodo, Bilbo, it's been good knowing you. You're on your own. Hope you make it back." And the narrator comes right out and says that those final steps were the bravest thing Bilbo ever did, and he faced them all alone. It was a moment of truth for Bilbo by himself. So there's the contrast between those two. Note as well the different consequences, the different significance of those. Bilbo, yeah, it's a good thing he went on. What happened? Well, some dwarves got rich, and so did Bilbo. Frodo, where it came down to something of ultimate importance, Frodo couldn't do it alone. And let me throw one last thing into the mix, and that is Gollum was alive because Frodo learned to pity Gollum. And those of you who've read the secondary literature, this is all plagiarized. This is not mine, as you'll recognize. It's Frodo's pity for Gollum that saves the day when Frodo's will fails. So, either of you have...
There's also something to be said as far as that theme goes, that as concerns Gandalf. We already talked about a lot about Gandalf's role, but especially in the theme that we hear so often that about teaching the people the correct principles and letting them govern themselves. When we learn more about the wizards, Gandalf, when his true role is revealed at the end of the books, and then in some of the appendixes of The Lord of the Rings, it talks about why the wizards had come to Earth. And it said after Sauron had come back to Middle-earth and had started consolidating his power, over time the wizards kind of appeared on Middle-earth. Nobody knew where they came from. And it was afterwards said that they came out of the far west and were messengers sent to contest the power of Sauron and to unite all those who had the will to resist him and to move them to good deeds and to valiant deeds. But they were forbidden to match his power with power or to seek to dominate elves or men by force and fear. And you especially see that in Gandalf, that this is an incredibly powerful individual, but his main role is to set them on the right path, be there with them, but when the important choices usually come down, they have to face them on their own. So he teaches the correct principles, in a sense, and then lets them govern themselves.
Just have a brief thing to add. Actually, when I was thinking about themes to talk about, one thing I thought of is how a similar quest may be to a mission, an LDS mission. And the one thing I'd written down is companions are good, but some decisions have to be made on your own. And I think that this really holds true. That my answer would be that companions, in a very broad sense, not just the mission sense, are necessary but not sufficient for our ultimate salvation, that each of us have individual strengths. You look at the Fellowship of the Ring, is apparent even from the movie. Every person, a member of that nine-member fellowship, had something that they brought to the table, and each one of them was necessary but not sufficient. And even though they seem to sort of fall along the wayside until it narrows down to Frodo and Samwise and then narrows down to Frodo and, well, and Gollum, each one of them was necessary to get to that point. Just as actually in The Hobbit, Bilbo spares Gollum as well when he could have knifed him. And you start to see an interconnectedness of everything, even people that you might see as the enemy and on the other side. Gollum, in fact, is, we are told, is a hobbit, a former hobbit who had been corrupted by his desire for the ring to the point that he is no longer recognizable as a hobbit. And yet he has a crucial role to play in the saving of all Middle-earth. Just an interesting point.
Before we get too caught up in the kindness...
Up to the mic, John.
Before we get too caught up in whatever meaning there is, it's a very short comment, I think. It's a very small group. There's also the thing that struck me is how incredibly violent the good guys are. Because, yeah, we're killing a golem, and they spare them. That's how it works.
The comment was the characters, the heroes in Tolkien's writings don't appear to have a problem with violence. A friend of my son's was not permitted to see the movie. My son was, and this friend's mother was shocked when she heard that my son had seen it, because she said, there's people getting decapitated. And I tried explaining that, no, it's just orcs getting decapitated. It's okay. So the is the idea that these are not embodiments of Christian virtue because they're a bit too violent?
Well, no, a few things struck me as, you know, like bringing in a few things that he now views being racist because he was a product of his own time. I think there's a lot of things that sort of creep through Tolkien's works that in some ways sort of, I don't know, I'm not sure if the words represent a fallen human race or just a fallen race, or, I mean, I'm sure he has a good allegory there to draw some fallen race, but, you know, allegorically they could be some dark group of humans that sort of just doesn't share the same high regard for life and for things as do, you know, say white people.
One thing Tolkien never found a happy place for orcs in his mythology. Originally, the idea was that they were corrupted elves. But then why don't they live forever and why can't they be uncorrupted? Because one thing that's clear in all of Tolkien's writings is that the elves are irredeemable. Tolkien himself didn't know what to do with an irredeemable but sentient creature. Tolkien couldn't swallow... For Tolkien, if it's sentient, it has a soul. And if it has a soul, it can't be irredeemable. So that is just an observation that Tolkien recognized the problem, but in some respects, I guess this emphasizes the limits to which you can hope to draw religious content out of this. His even when commenting himself on what the significance of the story is, it's, well, to the extent that it's about anything other than itself, it's about death and immortality. But first and foremost, it's a story about itself. Now, I'm not sure that that addresses your comments about race, but let me see if the other panelists have anything they want to add.
There were really two comments. One was race, one was, you know, I mean, the idea, I mean, I'm not sure exactly where it was going, but, you know, there might be some people of particular persuasions that would say, you know, saving Gollum might be sort of symbolic of let's not have a death penalty or something, but, you know, there certainly is plenty of death penalty going on in the
Let me make one further point about Gollum. And Laura was mentioning this too. One of what still, so far as I can tell, stands as the premier commentary on Tolkien, The Road to Middle-earth by Tom Shippey, he discusses the idea of interlacement as a prominent theme in Tolkien's writings. And we mentioned that Gollum comes in and saves the day at the end. That's not only an illustration of Frodo's pity helping out down the road, but it's an illustration of providence in the end. What appears to us to be providence, these fortuitous Gandalf appears at just the right time to stop the trolls from eating the dwarves, things of that nature, goes back to the comment at the end of The Hobbit, these things don't work themselves out just for your own benefit. Others? Comments? Questions?
Come on up to the mic.
Okay.
Thanks.
One of my questions is for Jason, kind of. It's when you earlier when you mentioned the wizards and how they'd come to fight against Sauron, and they'd been told, you know, they're not supposed to fight against him directly, and they're not supposed to compel the people on Middle-earth and everything. Would Saruman then be kind of, in a way, like Lucifer again, you know, falling and, you know, in his pride and everything like that, going to evil? And then if you want to talk about that. And then also there was something I noticed in them that I kind of would like all your input on. It was when the hobbits come back, both of them find kind of problems at home. When Bilbo gets back, he finds that his stuff is getting sold in this auction because everyone thinks he's dead. And then when Frodo gets back, he finds that Saruman has come to the Shire and has been kind of destroying it and putting up factories and things. And I was wondering if you saw any significance in that.
Start with
Yeah, there's definite parallels there. In some ways, the story of Saruman's a much better example of the power of evil than the character of Sauron, because, as you know, at least in Lord of the Rings, Sauron's not a character. He's just the bad guy. You never see him. He doesn't talk. You know, there's the eye of Sauron, but he's not somebody. He's not Darth Vader. They don't have a big sword fight with him at the end and finally defeat him. Saruman's a much better example of the corrupting power, and that when it talks about the wizards that came out of the West, from the beginning, the two most powerful were Saruman and Gandalf. And so they looked to both of them for leadership when they'd have these councils with other wise men. But as you learn more, Saruman, you see how it creeps in over, you know, in their time span, like hundreds of years, how he starts, he learns about the ring, and then he desires, he thinks the only way to beat Sauron is by getting the ring, and then he starts thinking, if I had the ring, what could I do? And then you see much more of a corrupting influence of power. And in that way, yeah, it's almost a better parallel of the story of Lucifer than we see with Sauron in some respects. And what was the other? Oh, the industry? Any comments? There's a strong anti-industrial element in, I mean, in that the whole time they're trying to get to this evil factory, Mount Doom, that seems to be smoking like a big chimney all the time. And a lot of that comes pretty directly from Tolkien's own childhood, how at a very young age, after his father died, his mother moved he and his brother out to a rural area that was a few miles outside Birmingham. And it was just far enough, this is 1896, so it was just far enough that even though they were only like a mile out of the city, it was very rural. All they saw maybe were some horse carts that came through every once in a while, and then a couple years later, when they were forced to move into the city so their mom could help him survive, he hated it. It was absolutely contrasted with this idyllic existence that he'd had in this rural area, and that never left him. And it shows up dramatically in the, especially when the hobbits come back to the Shire at the end of Return of the King. Any other comments on that?
My thoughts on sort of the odd post-endings of both might be, one was that the Shire just wasn't as separate as people thought, specifically the hobbits. And I think that comes back to the interconnectedness that we were talking about. Certainly in the beginning of both the trilogy and the Hobbit, there's this notion that the Shire is just its own little place, and things that go on outside, that is none of our affair. It will not touch the Shire. True, Frodo thinks that he partly has to go to preserve the Shire, but that really brings me to my second thought, which is it may be just a sign that change is inevitable and that preservation isn't really a feasible goal, and that maybe you just have to accept that some things are going to change and you can control the extent and the degree, but that the Shire isn't going to stay the same as it was, even though they had a successful quest. And those are my thoughts on it.
Jason observed that there's the anti-technological bent in Tolkien. That's tied to some deeper themes that I don't know if I have a completely solid grasp on. I don't know if Tolkien ever completely worked it out, but in Tolkien's letters, he insists that there's a difference between power or magic and something that he calls art. Power is what the ring provides and what Saruman ultimately wants. It's power just gets you the goal. And this is a moving